Welcome, Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller. Melissa Crick is the executive director of the Valley Contractors Workforce Foundation. More importantly, her work as the president of the Paradise Unified School District Board helped to reestablish the school district after the massive 2018 Camp Fire in Northern California's Butte County devastated the community. Coincidentally, when I spoke to Melissa on July 29th about conducting this interview, the ribbon cutting for the Paradise Elementary School, the final restoration in the district, was taking place. You might also recognize Melissa from her appearance on a previous podcast episode featuring Ukrainians Yuri Kushner and Svetlana Blinova. Kurt Vonnegut wrote in his book Hocus Pocus, "Every so often in the midst of chaos, you come across an amazing, inexplicable instance of civic responsibility. Maybe the last shred of faith people have is in their firemen." Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you for having me. Happy to return.
So I want to start out. The reason that I have you on here is because of my prior co-host, Pat LaMarche, who is on vacation right now. I hope she's having a great time up in Alaska. But you had the opportunity of speaking with her after the campfire. And I seem to remember in talking to you before that there were many, many reports that included you as a witness or something. And you, I believe, said that you'd never even talked to them. So tell me about your experience with Pat.
Yeah, so you're correct. We, shortly after the fire, I read my personal story from that day probably a dozen times from various news outlets and media organizations, and had never shared the story, and it certainly wasn't accurate. And so very early on, I was hesitant to cooperate, at least on a personal level, with any sort of reporting agency or media agency. I, of course, had the responsibility to share very publicly what was happening with relationship to my duties in the community. But I met Pat through a friend, through music, actually, Lee Oscar, the musician. His wife was good friends with Pat as well. And so she called me and said, "Hey, I have this amazing friend who is a journalist and who's very interested in your story and has incredible integrity and really wants to know the details." And so we invited her up and she came up to Paradise and actually stayed with my family. And she covered the story of the school district and very intimately was able to capture a version that had never been shared before. She met with our superintendents, with myself, with others. And so you'll hear us often say that Pat's the only one that truly has our story. And she's certainly the only one that really shared it accurately.
Yes. And I know, I'm not sure what outlet she reported for in the first place, maybe the Huffington Post. I know that was one that she was working for at the time, but it also did come out in her book, Still Left Out in America.
Yep.
So I actually reread portions of what happened in Paradise, and she paired it up with what was happening in Louisiana with Hurricane Katrina, because it's these unnatural disasters that created homelessness.
Yeah, that's correct. And that book was her intent in coming out. It was widely publicized that immediately after the fire, 100% of our district became McKinney-Vento, which of course is the Homeless Displaced Students Act. And Diane and Pat are good friends. Diane was the author of that original legislation, or co-author, I believe. And so they were interested in that story of how one district becomes 100% McKinney-Vento overnight. And then we had had some significant struggles accessing resources that should have been a right to our students based on that legislation. So Pat was very interested in hearing how we were navigating that process and what that looked like, and really understanding how in 2018, McKinney-Vento was not as widely recognized as it should be.
And I have talked about the McKinney-Vento before. In fact, we had Diane Nyland on as a guest in the past, and that is an important component of those that are experiencing homelessness, that they've got the opportunity to stay in their school district. Now, unlike Louisiana, Paradise made the decision to bring back the school district and insist that 100% of the students get back into a public school. So how did that decision take place?
That was really the incredible leadership of our board and our superintendent at the time. Michelle John was our superintendent. And so within days of the fire, we had a request from our local county office of education to support us in essentially dividing our district and our students for at least the coming school year and the remainder of the 2018 school year it was suggested that they would be split up and then sent to our neighboring communities, absorbed into those districts, which was, that offer was made out of a place of compassion, I believe, because you have to understand that we lost more than 90% of our community. And so in those early days, the thought was that it's insurmountable. There's no way that we could offer services to kids. And so to create the lesser impact, they wanted to get kids into existing schools in surrounding communities. But Paradise, almost from day one, we knew that we were going to keep our families, our communities, our school communities and climates together. And so we took a lot of heat for some of our decisions. We actually housed our students first in the mall, the Chico Mall. So we have Paradise sits at the top of a mountain, so to speak. And so in the valley, we have Chico and Oroville are the two valley communities below us. And so very early on, we rented quite a lot of space in the Chico Mall, and we had families coming in there. We immediately distributed laptops to all of our students, and we're communicating that way. We went to sort of a hybrid version of online learning with some in-classroom time in the mall. And then we accumulated a number of very unusual buildings. We actually were able to negotiate a hardware store that was recently emptied. It had been owned by, I believe, Osh Hardware, and then Ace Hardware was picking it up. And they were in between that sales process. So it was a very large, empty commercial building. So we were able to negotiate and actually put our junior high into that hardware store. And it was such a quick turnaround because we only had, you know, a number of days with kids outside of school. So we literally just took the top shelves and the lower shelves out of the aisles and left the middle shelf and pushed chairs up to it. And those were our classrooms. We served breakfast on checkout lane one, and parents checked their students in and out in lane four. And it was, garden center was our PE area. We had a large abandoned Facebook warehouse out near the airport, which became our high school. And it was just a multi-story just warehouse building with some office space. Put the high school in there. That actually took one-time special legislation because it was across the street from our small rural airport, and you cannot have a school anywhere near an airport. But we worked with our local and state leaders to allow for that. We had our alternative high school was in the local Boys and Girls Club, and that was a somewhat unfortunate situation because they had to come in and create their classrooms every day and then pack them up and remove them every day so that Boys and Girls Club after school program could happen for the Chico community. Oroville Elementary Union District gave us an entire school. They were in declining enrollment and had a school that they were able to take the very small numbers and put them into another school within their district, and were able to give us an entire elementary school. Durham Unified Elementary, which is another very small rural community just adjacent to Chico, offered us a couple of modular classrooms on their very small rural campus. And so we were very much scattered in a number of really unique locations, but we were together. And I think that was the most critical part. And when we look back and we talk to families and students, we talk about impact, everybody consistently will say the best thing we did was keep people together, because we didn't then have a bunch of kids that had experienced this significant tragedy sort of mixed into various school communities. They were with their peers who had experienced the same thing. And so it's something that I'm very proud of. But in those early days, we spent a lot of time wondering if we were making right decisions. How could it possibly be correct to put kids in a hardware store or a Facebook building? But it was really, really important to us that they knew that Paradise Unified would be there and that we would make everything okay.
That is fantastic. I am a viewer of the television program Abbott Elementary, and you said that you had students in a shopping mall. Is that correct?
Yeah. The very early days, we were just in the local mall in Chico. They had some, like all malls in America these days, they had a number of commercial spaces empty. And so we went in and just kind of said, you know, what total space do you have available and can we have it today? And so our teachers, our staff, I could never say enough about the people in Paradise Unified, the teachers, the bus drivers, the lunch ladies, the yard aides. I mean, just everybody was all hands on deck from day one. And so these folks went in and created a school space in that mall in 48 hours. I mean, it was incredible. They had put together poster boards and signs that had the various school mascots and logos. And I mean, they made every effort to make sure that these were Paradise schools, no matter what location we were in.
Yeah. What a way to maintain school spirit and all that. Yeah. It's such a wonderful story to hear. So You mentioned airport restrictions, which is something that I've never even heard of. What is the restriction on airports and schools?
Yeah, I'd never heard of it either. It makes sense if you think about it. You wouldn't want an airplane falling on a school. And so I think True. That's the long and short of it is that there. My understanding is there are many restrictions about what types of businesses can be within so many miles of an airport. And schools are certainly high on that list. Typically, when you have malfunctions around an airport, either unfortunately planes come down or parts are lost or whatever the case may be, I understand now that it typically happens in a very close proximity to that airport. And so it's very, very unusual that you would have allowance for a school. And we were directly across the street. I think it would have never happened except for that our airport, our Chico airport, was closed many years ago and it had been reopened, but only on a partial basis. So it was really kind of private planes and smaller planes. And so we were able to make it happen. Otherwise, I don't think it would have.
And I also think about the logistics. You have all these students that are now in completely different buildings. What was the busing situation like for the school?
Well, let me just tell you, our transportation department deserves some sort of incredible recognition because I do not know how they were able to make it work. We had families as much as 2 hours away attending our schools every day. And our transportation department was able to coordinate needs for those students. And they became very, very creative. We had a number of families that were working with us that had sort of pledged that we'll put all the kids in our car and drive them to a mutual point where we can meet and be picked up by the bus. But we had buses traveling up to 2 hours each direction. And we did that for a number of years. It was not just those early days. Paradise Unified committed to that for the first few years after the fire because there was no housing in Paradise. And we did return to our campuses in Paradise the following school year. We were able to sort of imagine, you could say, the campuses that were not a total loss. We had the partial loss situations cleaned up. A number of our campuses, we lost one or two buildings sort of on the outer edges. And so in that first year, that was addressed. And then those campuses were reimagined in that second year so that we could get kids back on the ridge. And then, of course, we began building very quickly. So that required us not only to address those early transportation issues where we were bringing kids to Chico and Durham and Oroville and a number of other locations, which was incredibly complex. But then additionally, when we returned to Paradise the following year, we were bringing kids from many, many surrounding communities up to Paradise. And so we purchased a number of vans. We purchased additional buses. Of course, we had some insurance proceeds for some of what was lost, but then we had significant need beyond what was lost because before fire, when everybody was in town, we didn't need the fleet of vans and the additional things to do the traveling that we were doing after the fire. Our transportation department really worked endlessly. Rubina Hartwig was our director of transportation who retired this year. She worked around the clock and she worked with local organizations, with families in a really creative process to figure out how can we collectively honor these students' desire to return to Paradise Unified. And we really almost said no to anyone, no matter the distance. If they were Paradise Unified students and they wanted to return, they made it happen. Our transportation department made it happen again and again and again. And when we finally made the decision to end that busing practice a few years after the fire, it was a really contentious process with the community. We hosted a number of community meetings, and we had families extremely passionate attending those meetings and voicing that they were still 45 minutes away, but they had every intention of rebuilding in Paradise, returning to Paradise. They wanted their kids in Paradise schools. And so it was really heart-wrenching to finally get to that point and say, we've really got to. We cannot continue this practice indefinitely. And then even after, we were still working with community organizations to try to provide supports and sort of alternatives to traditional transportation. We were providing funding for parents, gas cards, a number of other resources, paying mileage. And we really did that until we got to a point where everybody was sort of collectively settled.
Next question, kind of in a celebratory thought, that first graduating class after all this happened, how was that for the students in the district?
Yeah, so that's an interesting phrase, that first graduating class, because what does that mean? Does that mean seniors for that year? Does that mean the freshmen, we call them our fire freshmen, right? The first 4 years. So for us, each graduating class was incredibly special. For that 2018 class, that's another interesting story of incredible partnership and really just a big push to make it happen. We were told that we could not graduate our 2018 students on our home field, our Omraith football field. You can imagine a small rural town in Paradise. We're a football community. We're, you know, very typical. And that field, we have graduated generations of folks. And so the community is really, really connected to that graduation process at Paradise High School. And so we heard loud and clear that our kids need to be graduating there. And we had very gracious offers from beautiful facilities all around us for graduation. But the community wanted to graduate in Paradise, especially that next spring after the fire. And so we had a number of trees on our campus that had been burned. They had not fallen, but they had been burned and they were deemed a hazard. And so we were told that we couldn't access the campus, couldn't use it for graduation because we would not be able to remove those trees in a timely enough manner. So the district reached out to, again, our local and state legislators, and we reached out to a number of community organizations that were responsible for assisting with the cleanup process at that point. We had the state agencies that had come up and we're dealing with sort of the decontamination process. But then we had a lot of local agencies that had taken the bid to remove hazards and other things. And so through that support from our legislators, there was a collective shift and it became a priority to address those trees. And I think it, forgive me off the top of my head, I think it was something crazy, like 67 trees in a very short period of time. Everybody said it will not happen, but through the support of James Gallagher and Doug LaMalfa and other leaders in our area, we came together and it did happen and we graduated that class. And it was the most emotional graduation I think I've been a part of on that field. And then, of course, you remember a year and a half later, the pandemic. And so Then we had a series of very emotional graduations and we had a very similar response when it came time to have our COVID graduations. You know, of course, most folks are doing Zoom graduations and that sort of thing. And again, in a tiny rural mountain community where COVID hadn't yet reached and folks were very passionate about the return and the access to that community, we had our drive-through graduations and kids would come up in the car and jump out with their mask on and run across the stage and do the handshake and get the hand sanitizer and get back in the car. And again, that process of reaching out to the county health organizations and our state supports and just saying, look, this is Paradise. We've got to do it different. We will do it safely. We will be very cautious, but we have to make this happen for the community. And again, I'm so proud of our district for the incredible efforts that they went to in reaching out for that support and really making it happen for our families.
And that sense of community is so wonderful. It's great to hear the story of that first class being able to graduate just like all their peers and just that push to do things as normally as possible in the most abnormal times of all. So what was the rebuilding progress of the district? And we could talk about the community as well, but getting the schools to where they are, because the last school is just opening this year. So what was the progress like for the rest of the district?
I do just want to clarify, Paradise Unified is nowhere near recovered. And we just did build Paradise Elementary. So we had our ribbon cutting yesterday, which was a monumental event for the community. Very emotional, absolutely a symbol of recovery. Paradise Elementary School was the most widely publicized school after our fire. It was one of our total loss sites. And there was all of this incredible imagery of like our superintendent and our director of maintenance standing in the middle of the rubble, crying and holding each other. And it was a symbol of our community. It held the name Paradise. And so it's a little bit serendipitous that it was the last physical school build. We still need to build. We're actively looking at our transportation and food services building. We have a ton more building to do. This was our last school, and we were only able to build a portion of that school because we have very limited funds. So we built two classroom wings. We actually need six classroom wings. And so we're actively pursuing funding to try to make that happen because that's a great need in our district. But when we came back after the fire, what we did was we had, I think, 12 sites the day of the fire. 11 of those were affected by fire. We had only one at the northernmost point of our district that was not touched by fire. So we had a large number of partial lost sites. And so we had those addressed. And then we had a meeting to sort of collectively vision how this was going to work for the next number of years. So for example, we took our junior high and combined it with our high school, which we had never done before. But the facility was large enough that we could house those kids collectively on that site for a few years. And we went through the process of whether or not we make it permanent. It wasn't, of course. We went back to having a junior high and a high school. We took the insurance proceeds and we tried to do our best to imagine what we would need in the immediate future. The other consideration is that our facilities were not new. As a small rural community, we had, of course, underfunded facilities, as all schools in the United States do. And so this tragedy presented a unique opportunity to provide some modernization to sites that desperately needed it. We had actually, just before the fire, months before, we had completed a facility master plan that highlighted about $200 million in needs for the district. And so we were well aware that these facilities were subpar. So the board made the decision to do a couple of things. First, we put in place a construction committee, which was two board members that could make decisions on behalf of the whole board on a very fast schedule. So that allowed us to really move ahead at a hyperspeed because we didn't need to bring these big decisions back to board meetings and gather five people and go through the whole song and dance. And so that group really worked tirelessly to identify what were our immediate needs. Our student numbers were far, far less because while a large portion of our community was scattered within about 2 hours of us and was passionate about participating in Paradise, we also had a huge portion of our community that went out of state, some went out of the country. Many folks went to the grandparents' house or the sister's house or the childhood friend's house because you couldn't get housing within hours of us. We had 60,000 people looking for a place to be. And so we had significantly reduced student numbers. We went to just below 50% within the first few weeks of our pre-fire enrollment. So we looked at our collective schools and we tried to figure out what would be the best course ahead. And so we identified elementary space, junior high space, high school space, and then we began building out from there. So we built the facilities that we would need first, and then we expanded upon that. We put together an enrollment committee, and those folks were genius. I don't know how they did it. Their projected enrollment numbers have been exact every year. And it's because of the level of commitment. They look at things like the number of permits pooled in the town of Paradise, in the greater county area. They work with nonprofit and resource organizations to find out what's the communication on families asking for resources in the area. And they use all that data to create this projected enrollment map that then allowed us to follow that lead in facilities. Paradise Elementary actually surprised us a bit because we had projected needing it a number of years out from where we are now. But we had this boom in our younger students' enrollment over the last couple of years. And so that is sort of credited to our Chamber of Commerce and Town of Paradise. They had done this really beautiful campaign to kind of let California know that Paradise is being rebuilt. It's one of the safest communities, arguably, within our greater mountain area because the forest that had once surrounded us is now mostly gone. We have fire-wise communities. When you drive through Paradise, you'll see that there's no vegetation within 5 feet of house. There's a very safe barrier up to 50 feet of every house. So it's very unlikely that Paradise will never experience an event like that again. And as a result of that, our affordable housing, our state-of-the-art schools, our collective community spirit, we have had a huge influx of new community members. And what we've been surprised to learn from the data is that most of those folks are sort of 22 to 40 years old, and they have kids or are looking to have kids. And that's really changed our demographics because Paradise was a bit of a retirement community before the fire. So all of a sudden, a few years ago, our construction committee enrollment community kind of said, hey guys, we're running out of space at Paradise Ridge Elementary, and we've got to build Paradise Elementary a whole lot faster. And we didn't have the dollars. So we went out for a community bond. We asked the community to help us cover that cost. And unfortunately, they were not able to because there were a number of additional things that had just happened. Our fire insurance is, of course, through the roof. People are paying 10 times what they were paying in 2018. Our county sheriff was really pushing a tax measure to support their services. It was a 1% tax increase countywide. So that passed. Our bond did not. We heard that message and supported it from the community. So once again, we reached out to those state leaders and we said, hey, you guys have got to help us come up with some dollars. Fortunately, California legislation has been very supportive of Paradise Unified and other fire communities across the state of California. So we were able to leverage some one-time funds and some additional support to begin the building process of Paradise Elementary. We built the first couple of classroom wings that will accommodate the students we have right now, but we very much need to find support to build those additional classroom wings because we're once again running out of space. And that's a great problem to have. We're excited about it.
Yeah, great problem to have, but the cost is incredible. I come from a school district that is constantly pushing bonds because we're another one of those communities that draws a lot of people. The population keeps going up. The school population keeps going up, and just trying to keep up with the populations is insane. And the fact that you transform the demographics after the fire, and I read quite a lot about how there are a lot of fire prevention protocols that went into place after this fire. So you probably are one of the safer communities in what is unfortunately a more problematic time when it comes to those wildfires.
Yeah, we are. And now we're the blueprint for future fire disaster communities. We work very closely with Pasadena and Altadena, with Maui, with all the other folks that have unfortunately experienced some version of this. And so they reach out to us to learn how we do things, including how we create our FireWise communities and safer communities moving ahead.
How many schools did you have before and how many do you have now? In that rebuilding, how close are you to what you had before?
So we had 12 sites the day of the fire. We have 8 now. And some of that was due to fire. Some of that was due to decisions made after the fire. For example, we had our Honey Run Academy was our community day school. So for our kiddos that would have been facing issues like suspension or things like that, we had a place that really provided in-district support. Most districts will send those students out of district. That's sort of a standard practice. Some districts do have that resource inside the district, and we did. After the fire, we unfortunately had to close that site. It became necessary. We just didn't have the student numbers for it, and we didn't have the facilities for it. So we are actually looking at bringing that site back as well. We're actively in the process of creating a space for that student population. So I suspect that we'll get back to 12 over the next number of years. But as we were able to sort of combine schools like Paradise Ridge Elementary that you heard me mention, before the fire, that was Ponderosa Elementary. So in Paradise in 2018, we had 2 elementary schools, Ponderosa Elementary on the east side of Paradise and Paradise Elementary School sort of on the west central side of Paradise. After the fire, we had lesser student numbers and lesser facilities. And so we put all the kids together in the Ponderosa site, but the community said, hey, we're Ponderosa and Paradise Elementary. We can't just be Ponderosa. So we renamed that site Paradise Ridge Elementary. Now there's actually conversation about whether or not we go back to Ponderosa because we've built Paradise Elementary. So we're in this sort of ever space of growth and change and kind of examining, do we bring back what we had before? Do we celebrate something new? What does it look like? And we always go back to the community and, you know, sort of, what say you? These are your schools. What do you think? What do you feel? And so we're excited to see what that process will bring. But I think ultimately, probably within the next 5 or 6 years, we'll reach that same site number because our student numbers continue to grow as families come home.
You mentioned too that Paradise has become kind of an advisory place for other school districts or other places that have experienced the kind of disaster that affected Paradise. And that was kind of how I got to know you, because you also served as an advisory to the Ukrainians who visited Paradise. Certainly not exactly the same situation of the disaster of a natural fire, but the war-torn portions of Ukraine. So the Sister City program allowed you to meet people we ended up interviewing. How did that transpire?
We work with a number of communities, and it continues to surprise me, the folks that find resource in our experience. And Ukraine was an example of that. They reached out through Rotary. I'm also the president of our local Rotary Club. And so the Open World Program is a congressional program. And like all good congressional programs, it leans on nonprofits. And so they had a great relationship with a number of nonprofits, including Rotary. And so we had a request through that program to host 6 Ukrainian delegates, and they were specifically interested in our post-fire process because, as it turns out, bombs and fire have the exact same result. And so they wanted to know, what does it look like to provide education during evacuation or displacement? How do you maintain a sense of community? What does economic development look like? What is the rebuild process? They were very interested in the American nonprofit and resource model because it's vastly different across Europe. So they wanted to know how we leveraged those nonprofit and resource agencies to sort of address those governmental shortfalls, which is very common in the U.S. So they spent about a week with us in Paradise, and they met with every local agency. I think their heads were spinning because our itinerary was very intense. We asked for a list of requests from them, things they were interested in learning, and then we put it together. And of course, being Paradise, all of the agencies are very, very willing to share. It doesn't matter if it's a local water company or garbage company, everybody has an interest in sharing what the process was so that we can lessen the next person's experience. We love that opportunity. And so those folks have learned quite a lot from Paradise. We maintain a fabulous relationship. We're constantly working with them and sharing information on what our process looks like now, 8 years later. They reach out to us pretty regularly with additional questions. And I so admire them in their process because they don't have sort of an end date or a rebuild start date like we did. We had a window of disaster and then immediately we jumped into recovery. They're still waiting for that opportunity because, of course, the conflict continues. And so one of the things that really surprises me about them and that I admire endlessly is that they're constantly updating those plans so that that first day that they're able to begin, they're ready for recovery. And so they'll reach out and ask for an opportunity to reconnect with our local water provider to ask questions there, or they want to know about PG&E and Power, the school district, any number of organizations. So we remain in close contact. And we have similar relationships with many other disaster communities. We've heard from tornado communities and other fire communities and hurricanes and floods and really almost every scenario.
So one of the outlets of this, which is also near and dear to my heart for Sacred Legions and the secular sainthood, is the art that's grown out of this as well. So because of the connection to Paradise and that Ukrainian visit, we were able to, first Sacred Legions was able to interview Yuri and Svetlana again, but we also started talking about providing art from Ukraine to be displayed in the United States to bring attention to the challenges that they're going through. And that started in Pat LaMarsh's hometown of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. They held an art exhibit there. We have the next one is scheduled in Eaton, Minnesota in September. It looks now like there might be another one in Husum, Germany. I think that's how it's pronounced, in October. And you've talked about bringing it to Paradise, maybe bringing it to Portland, Oregon. So this odd connection seems to have been growing.
Yeah, all of that credit goes to Pat. And I think that's another great example of the relationships that she built here, because of course the podcast that we were able to do with Svetlana and Yuri was really in many situations since the fire, when I encounter another community or another organization that is having similar difficulties that we did with telling their story and having it told accurately, expressing needs, I'll reach out to Pat and say, hey, these folks are not really getting the justice or the service that they need post-disaster or in the midst of it. And so can you help? And so that original podcast was, I had had a meeting with those folks and they were just expressing that there is a widespread belief that the United States doesn't care about the situation in Ukraine and that there's a lot of misnomer, there's a lot of misinformation. And so they were really wanting to do something to provide a voice. And so of course I called Pat and I said, listen, somebody needs to listen to these people. And she very graciously connected them with you. And that process was created. And it was very similar with the art show. Again, they were having the conversations of how do we create an opportunity to engage folks in conversations about what's going on and about the humanity of Ukraine and Ukrainians. How do we connect on a human level? And I said, I know, we called Pat. So we called Pat and we had a conversation and it came to the idea of what do you want to share? They wanted to share culture. So Pat said, let's do an art show. And she put it together and first one was sort of born. And then of course, through my role with the various recovery agencies and with Rotary, I talk endlessly about Pat and about Ukraine and many other things. I sort of, you know, everybody says I carry the bag of communities. So in that conversation process, when I'm attending my various conferences and trainings, we've had Rotarians from a number of communities, Portland and Arcata, California and San Francisco and many other areas reach out and say, hey, we want to host as well. And then Pat's doing similar things on her side. So she had a connection with Germany, and they witnessed what happened there in Carlisle, and they said, hey, us too. And so it just grows and expands, and that web of friendship and connection grows as well. And so I'm just super excited to be a part of it.
And that sense of connection, I absolutely love that, that because you know somebody that can do something that's interesting, you can connect other people to that. And then you've just got this expansion of great things happening. Now, are you involved in helping Ukrainians learn English? Am I correct in that?
Yes.
And how did that transpire?
Well, one of the things that we have done after their visit here, our six delegates, was one of the requests that they made was they wanted to continue to perfect their English. And so through looking for resources to do that to a greater degree, I found this great nonprofit, and I always get the name wrong. I'm going to actually pull it up on my screen so I can tell you correctly, because everybody should sign up.
Well, I love that you mentioned that, because one of the things that we try to promote in Sacred Legions is this idea of community volunteerism or self-care. These are things that are really important to Sacred Legions. And so any organization that's giving you the opportunity to volunteer and help others sounds fantastic.
Yeah. So I just through Googling, I found this organization. It is a nonprofit and it functions solely to assist Ukrainians with learning English for a number of reasons, ambassadorship, employment, because of course, a lot of Ukrainians are now living in countries outside of Ukraine. And so in order to be successful and to adjust to that new space, it's very important for them to develop those skills. And then they're very passionate as a people. They're very passionate about ambassadorship and being able to connect on a human level. So the program is, it's ENG, all capital, and then IN, and you can sign up online. They really are in need of native English speakers, and it's really neat because you don't need any teaching experience. You don't really need much, just a willingness to connect with people. They do ask that you commit to at least 1 hour per week. You can certainly do more. Some of us do. They have individuals, so you can connect with a one-to-one situation, or you can actually host groups. They will send you quite an extensive survey about your areas of interest, your personal expertise, and they do that because they try to connect you to folks that have similar areas of interest. So, for example, if you're a scientist, they'll connect you to a scientist, a teacher to a teacher. They have young students, as I believe it goes down to as young as 4 years old, all the way up to 80 years old. And so you can really sort of set preferences. Are you open to talking to a classroom of kindergartners? Would you like to connect with some high school students or college students? Do you want to have just you and another guy your similar age and you can chat about fishing and hunting? Really any level. They have folks that really want to do the regular practice of learning English. They want to learn all of our tenses and they want to understand how to better frame language in English. Or you have folks that just want to casually chat just to work on their pronunciation and their understanding of slang and those nuances that exist within our language. And so it's easy for anybody to support the support staff through that program. And I'll send you the information so that you can link it. They're wonderful. If you have any concerns or frustrations, they really work with volunteers to try to make it so easy for you. So I now have like one student group and three individuals, and we just have so much fun. So once a week for 1 hour, I connect with each of them, and it's just been a great opportunity to learn more about their culture and their experience, and then also share some of ours. So it's just a ton of fun.
So when you say connect with them, are you able to physically connect? Are they in your community, or is this Zoom related? Or
yeah, my groups specifically are in Poland and Bulgaria and Ukraine. So I don't believe that there are any in the United States. I could be wrong. I've not run across that, but you're typically connecting by Zoom or by phone.
And I know we used Alexander was an interpreter for us during the interview that we conducted because, of course, neither Pat nor I speak Ukrainian. I think he lives in the United States somewhere. I'm not sure
where.
He does.
He lives in Sacramento, California, and he was employed through the Open World program and still is. He's still hosting additional groups through Open World, and he's been doing it for many, many years. He moved to Sacramento many years ago during a previous conflict, and so has been in the States for over 20 years, I believe. Fantastic human. So, and I stay in contact with him as well. He supports a lot of what we do. both with the art show, of course, with the previous podcast. We have a number of additional small projects going with our Ukrainian friends. And so he's always wildly supportive of anything that we're doing.
So I'm curious as well, you're the executive director of the Valley Contractors Workforce Foundation. Mm-hmm. Was that a group that you were working for prior to the campfire, or was it a result of the campfire? What is their role in all of that?
Yeah, direct result of the campfire. Previous to the fire, I had been with an agency, California Vocations, that provided services to adults with intellectual developmental disabilities. And I've been with them for well over a decade. I never thought I would leave. I love, love, love that agency and the folks that we support. But after the fire, that agency, like many others, was then spread across a number of counties. We had previously been one of the largest employers in Paradise and really kind of concentrated on that ridge area. After the fire, they were spread kind of 2 hours in either direction. And so I was faced with the decision to really focus my support on the recovery of that agency or the recovery of the community. And pre-fire, I held many roles in our local resource agencies as it was. And so after the fire, I was well suited to sort of jump into recovery. And obviously, I'm very passionate about my community, my school district. And so I knew that I was going to need to be able to have the commitment to those agencies and support that recovery process. And with California Vocations, it was becoming quite clear that we were going to need to duplicate the programs that we had so diligently built over a number of years in new communities. And so I sort of recognized that we needed someone new. We needed someone who could come in and really be a visionary and imagine new programs and new communities and not sort of try to recreate what we once had. And so I had started sharing out gently that, hey, I'm thinking that I can't be as committed as I want to be to this and I might be open to a change. And so a friend of mine who I sat on a couple of boards with, Amy Rohr, who is the executive director of the local contractors exchange, Valley Contractors Exchange in Chico, she had created, her and her board had created Valley Contractors Workforce Foundation. And that was an agency that was really looking at addressing the issues of our nationwide and certainly local contractor shortage. We have a need for folks in the trades, and that was impacting our recovery. Amy was a campfire survivor. She lost her home. Her and her husband rebuilt their home themselves, their contractors. She actually added her contractor license after the fire. She got HAZWOP certified to clear her own property. She really is this incredible human. She's such a powerhouse of just vision and determination. And so she approached me one day and said, hey, what do you think? We created this foundation and the intent really is to get folks trained into the local trades so that we can address the recovery rebuild process with the campfire, but then also our greater community. We've had a number of fires since. We just had the big park fire, which was national news. And so with each of those fires, what happens here in Northern California, we add those sort of numbers to the total structure loss, right? So any local can tell you, we lost over 14,000 residential structures in the Paradise Fire, and we lost 6,000 in subsequent fires. So we have those numbers, and Amy knows those numbers better than anybody else because she works in the local contractors exchange. She leads it. And so she said, I've gotten it to a point. She was wearing dual hats, executive director of the foundation and the exchange. She said, I've gotten to a point, but we really need to incorporate schools and community. And so I'm looking for somebody that has that education and community resource piece. And I've got the contractor trades piece and we can marry it together and do something really special. And so it was an easy yes, because the opportunity to work with her and then also address that build issue that we were seeing in Paradise, because sitting on the resource and recovery boards that I do, our number one issue has always been housing, 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 housing. We had a shortage of housing before the fire. We certainly had one immediately after the fire. We still have one to date. We had people wanting to build without contractors to build. We had folks that were wanting to learn so that they could do it themselves. There was a massive movement of owner builder after the fire. And so in the couple of years since I came on, I made the transition in 2023. We've really built it into a program that provides no cost construction trades training through a community benefit model. So we're actively building houses in Paradise for fire survivors. 3-bedroom, 2-baths are what we're currently doing. We've done 1-bedroom, 1-bath, tiny houses. We also are building community centers with the Red Cross and other agencies. And we provide construction support to all of our local nonprofits. So We have one agency that's building food boxes. Butte County Local Food Network is building food boxes and supplying those to folks throughout the community, especially in our rural areas, so that they can provide fruits and vegetables for themselves. We've built hundreds and hundreds of garden boxes for them. We've done projects with almost every local school, our parks and recs departments. We're running construction camps for kids, career fairs to just introduce the idea of trades, just incredible things. We're now doing scholarship opportunities, just really, really amazing things. And all, again, through those connections of shared friendship and investment in community. Amy was sitting on local boards and really active in the recovery as well. And so it's just that simple process of, hey, do you want to?
Well, and I think that's why I really wanted to have you on here. You share the same kinds of passions. You've got connections to people that are very, very strong and meaningful. And you've got a sense of community that's very, very strong and meaningful. And the characteristics are just perfect for that secular sainthood. And when you talk about the contractor shortage and how it impacted the rebuilding of Paradise, in that microcosm, it's very much what it is throughout the country, that we're experiencing the shortages of contractors. I recently stayed in Maine with a friend who had to rebuild a house after a fire, and the contractor woes were just incredible because there's not enough, so it takes longer.
Yeah. And let me tell you, for your listeners with your contractor rows, reach out to your local exchange. They are a resource for you. I feel like I sort of wear that banner constantly now. The exchange serves both contractors and the greater community. So if you want to hire a contractor, reach out to them first to make sure you're hiring somebody who has great references and a quality contractor. If you have a hiccup in construction, call them. All things, reach out to your local exchange because they're incredible. And then they do things like create a foundation to help with recovery. So incredible resource. I had no idea. I have no history in construction, no background in that area. I did not know what an incredible resource contractors exchanges are. And now I feel like I've sort of added that to my bag and I'm always screaming it from the rooftops.
Yeah, you do become a bit of a disciple for these great organizations mm-hmm. and the great things that are going on. So is there anything that I haven't talked about yet that you would like to share about what you're doing in Paradise or efforts that you think are important to highlight?
Well, I think we could talk forever about Paradise and the things happening in Paradise and the many connections that we've made and the projects that we now support, obviously working with all of our other fire communities and supporting communities like Ukraine and Uganda and many others. So it's sort of an endless conversation, but I think I'll leave everybody with the idea that recovery is never really done. And so in the recovery community, we always joke that you're only relevant until the next disaster. And that's, unfortunately, that's so true. You know, you've heard me share that we don't have dollars to finish building our elementary schools. We don't have dollars for our food and transportation buildings. Paradise needs help. Our school districts, our town council, our, you know, every agency, we're closing and exhausting recovery agencies, including the foundation, Valley Contractors Workforce Foundation. We're right now having conversations about whether or not we continue because we are a unique agency that doesn't check traditional funding boxes. And so we rely on donations and grants. And with our current climate, unfortunately, there's a bit of unrest these days, and we're not seeing the grants, the federal and state grants that we once did. We're not seeing the supports available. And there's a lot of hesitancy for funding because nobody knows what tomorrow looks like. And then also just your average folks are kind of tightening up the wallet because times are tough. And we understand that. But if you are near a disaster community or you have a relationship with a disaster community, maybe just remember that 1 year, 5 year, 8 years later, they still need help and support. So if you're able to reach out, be curious and just share their information. I agreed to today's podcast, not because I want to talk about myself. I hate that. But I love an opportunity to say, hey, here are the amazing things that are still happening. And if you can be involved in any way, if you can share the story, you never know what that connection leads to. We might host our next community. We might find some funding. We might, who knows? And so I think that's really the message, is always be curious and just keep sharing.
Well, I truly appreciate you coming on. And I do know that you have that reluctance of being featured as a secular saint. And quite honestly, that humility is across the board. Every person that I've ever interviewed, I think one of the defining factors of that is that you have that humility. And the main thing is that good things are taking place, not simply because of you, because you highlighted so many people in your community that I may or may not ever have an opportunity to speak to. But all of those people, the teachers, the bus drivers, the builders, just an entire community coming together and saying, this is what we need to do to get ourselves back on our feet and to recover from this and to rebuild that sense of community is just fantastic. So I think in itself, that is worthy of recognition as a secular sainthood situation.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I will leave you with one very cute story, if you'd like to hear it, about our relationship with Ukraine when they visited. One of the things I tell people when they ask, how do you have anything in common? I love to tell the story of they obviously were interested in our educational process. So one of the last stops we made was touring our schools. We had students in session and we took them to a second grade classroom. And so we came in and of course we have six Ukrainian delegates and Alexander, our translator, who you met, and Alexander right. is very domineering. And so all of the little eyeballs in the classroom are lighting up because you have everybody speaking Ukrainian and then English and then translating in Ukrainian. And so they're just fascinated with what's happening. And so our superintendent, Tom Taylor, who is another just incredible human, says, boys and girls, we have this delegation from Ukraine. And he goes through the whole official response. And so then I tell the kiddos, they came here today because their community is burnt as well. And so they want to learn from us. They want to know what happened in paradise, what was good and what was bad. So these folks all have kids. They have to go home and tell their kids what they learned in paradise. So what would you tell them? What's your message from you kids to their kids? And these little second graders started to raise their hands and they said, tell them everything will be okay. Tell them grownups need hugs too. Tell them their community will be better. Tell them they'll have parties and celebrations and everything will be brand new. Tell them to tell every single person they love them because you don't know when you'll see them again. All these amazing things. And so I thought, oh no, what have I done? And I looked over and all of these incredible, strong Ukrainian men and women are crying and the teacher's crying. And these sweet kids were just so genuine with their messages of encouragement. And then our superintendents, David McCready and Tom Taylor, who are just made of steel, they're crying. And it was this really incredible moment where we sort of collectively realized all at once, paradise was realizing these kiddos, they were babies. They were, you know, teeny tiny babies at the time of the fire, but they have this information in their brains and they're sharing it. And then our Ukrainian partners are realizing everything's going to be okay. And I just love that moment. I think of it often. It was such an incredible experience and I was so happy to get to participate in it.
Well, I think that is a great way to close out the episode. I love anecdotes, and that is a beautiful anecdote. Thank you again, Melissa, for agreeing to be on the show, and best wishes to your community there in Paradise.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Callan. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.